Welcome to the AEW Match Guide Podcast, where we deep dive into the best matches in AEW history. Brought to you by the Social Suplex Podcast Network and your host, Sam Brown.
Hello and welcome to the AEW Match Guide Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Brown. Thank you for joining me. Today, it is a special edition of the Match Guide, where for the first time, we move beyond the ropes of a Tony Khan ring to the cerulean blue of New Japan Pro Wrestling to pay tribute to Hiroshi Tanahashi, who will be retiring at Wrestle Kingdom in the Tokyo Dome on January 4, just a few weeks away. If you enjoy the show today, you can subscribe or rate it on your podcast app of choice, support the Social Suplex Podcast financially through Red Circle, and make sure you check out all of the other great shows on the Social Suplex Podcast Network, where we cover all aspects of the world of pro wrestling. We've got One Nation Radio, Keeping It Strong Style, All Things Elite, Tunnel Talk, the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast, Wrestle Art with Chris Things, and Imp's AEW Adventure. You can become part of the Social Suplex community by joining our Discord, where you can chat with the hosts of all our podcasts, as well as other wrestling fans from around the world. Links for all of these things are in the podcast description below. My guest for today is one of the four musketeers of the Social Suplex, co-host of the preeminent New Japan podcast, Keeping It Strong Style. It's the young boy, Joshua Smith, and we're going to be discussing Hiroshi Tanahashi versus Kota Ibushi from the final of the 2018 G1 Climax. Young boy, it's great to have you here on this podcast for the first time, mate.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I know we had intended to do this a couple times during the original runs. You know, I guess you would call it season one or season two of the Match Guide, but I didn't take priority, you know, so.
Look, one of the two of us just kept on flaking out on their podcast commitments to the network, and the other ones kept on going. I'll let the listeners decide who that was and who wasn't.
No, it's okay. But
other priorities.
But yeah, when you reached out, I wasn't expecting it, but I'm excited to do some audio here together. And yeah, we're taking, you know, honestly, the time that we're doing right now, I've kind of itched out so I could continue to do the Tanahashi series, but you're catching me right in the middle of a down day where it's like I'm not planning to record audio anyways. So you got me up here early. I'm ready to do this. You did have me doing a little bit of problem solving this morning, though.
Yes. Yeah. Look, working out how to record this thing. The most recent series I've done, I have to, you know, give Floyd chops for and raps for dealing with the technical side of things. It's been a while since I was in the podcast game. Skype is no longer a thing. The ever reliable, ever trusty Holden Commodore of podcast recording machines is no longer. So we had to work out how we're going to record this thing. But yeah, look, I appreciate you being here as well, Josh. I'll also give a shout out to Rich Ladder. One of the reasons I'm doing this, I was listening to one of his solo One Nation radios a couple of weeks ago, and he mentioned, look, Tanahashi's career is finishing. Now is the time. If you want to write the article, if you want to do the podcast, do it now. Yeah. This is my favorite match of all time, pretty much. And I was like, I've never written an article just about this. I've never done a podcast just about this. Now is the time. And yeah, I was really excited to get you on as well. I do need to give a shout out to the Ace of the Universe series on the Keeping It Strong Style Patreon. I've been listening through to it. For those of you who aren't following it, Josh goes in there, a real in-depth look at every year of Hiroshi Tanahashi's career, looks at the news of the time, not just for Tanahashi, but in Puro Rezo generally. Talks about the matches that Tanahashi has, the stories, the rivalries. If you're a fan of Japanese pro wrestling, if you're a fan of Hiroshi Tanahashi, jump in there and get it. It's a great deal. I think you pay like $5 American and you get access to it. It's about like an hour, hour and a half for each year. Great audio content, particularly if, like me, you're getting really pumped for the Wrestle Kingdom that's coming up to watch Hiroshi Tanahashi's last match and getting excited to see the ace go out high.
Yeah, I appreciate those kind words. That's a really great synopsis of what it is, and it's a pretty big passion project. And I've got 2012 recorded. I need to get it uploaded. I'm pretty much done with 2013. I just need to do some viewing. And you know what? I'm kind of a sadist. Like, there's this part of me that's like a perfectionist, I could just go watch those matches on World and that be a day and then record it the next day. But I was like, oh wait, didn't Ronaldo and Josh Barnett have some stuff on Access where they recorded this? Maybe I could get some extra context if I go and watch it that way. And then it's like, that stuff doesn't exist. So I'm going through back channels and I actually found somebody who has the majority of those matches and they're sending me a drive. So I'm like, all right, well, it only delays me like 2 or 3 days. No big deal. I'll just watch it that way. And so it's, if you imagine, it's like it is 1 to 1.5 hours of audio, but then there's also, I got to watch the matches. I have to basically read through Tanahashi's biography and life story and every single other ancillary bit of research and historical context. And then plus just going through the matches and the cage match and contextualizing it. It's a lot of freaking work. I never realized how big a project it was that I was really taking on. The original idea was just, yeah, I'll just pick two matches from his year and review them. And that will be that. Somehow it just morphed into the monster that it is now. But I'm pretty sure there's nobody else in the world anywhere that's doing what I'm doing. So hopefully, I don't know, somehow Hiroshi Tanahashi finds out about it and is like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, look, it's a labor of love. You make me feel lazy for just concentrating on one match and sometimes getting a bit annoyed and, you know, putting off the watching of the one match that I record on this podcast. But yeah, look, truly in-depth, really great stuff. If you're not listening to it, do yourself a favor, get in there. And we're just, I mean, perfect time. If you don't want to, it's great to go back and listen. I loved listening to the early stuff about his life, things that I didn't know. But, you know, you're getting to the peak years for Tanahashi right mm-hmm. now. Like, you're getting to the years that we know and love so well. The Kazuchika Okada rivalry is like just around the corner for you. So, yeah, if you want to listen, now's the time to jump in and do it.
Yeah, I've already got the 2012 audio deals with the early portions of that feud. And then 2013, obviously, it's pretty much the peak of the early portion of the feud. Yeah, they're going to have their other famous matches, but, you know, like, once Okada beats him in, like, October of 2013, it pretty much is established. Like, maybe I can't beat you in the dome, but I'm already the ace. Like, and Tanahashi, you know, he's going to have another, and we're going to talk about it here today. It's like, he's going to have one more IWGP reign in him. He's going to have one more G1 win. But his time as the top of the company, like, it is funny because we talk about the peak years and a lot of Western fans think of his peak years as being the golden age of New Japan, but it's really not. That's where he's sort of in this 1B role where Okada's already above him and he's trying to fend off the rest of the pack, the Kenny Omegas, the Ibushis, the Zack Sabre Juniors,
Naito
and everybody else that, you know, is part of that. But the reality is, it's like, he's already had all of his title runs. He's already had his time as like the main event and he's basically fighting Father Time at this point, which is, you know, it's funny because here we are in 2026 and it's or 2025 and we're already like, you know, way past this point, which was what, 2018. And even then it was like, can the ace still go?
Yep. Well, look, we're going to be getting deep into Raging Against the Dying Light when we start looking at this match. But I want to turn back the clock a little bit for you, Josh. Normally on this podcast, I ask people how they got into AEW. But for today's episode, I wanted to ask you about Hiroshi Tanahashi. What's your earliest memory of him? When did you become a fan of this wrestler?
So here's the thing with my fandom is like, being a Japanese wrestling fan wasn't always easy. Right. And I'm, even though I'm a hardcore wrestling fan, I'm not as crazy as some of the like Perezu like contingency that was deeply embedded in what was going on with New Japan in real time in say like 2011, 2012, 2013, like just the years prior to New Japan World launching. These were the same people that were like watching on Ustream and Nico and all these other different, you know, back channels. But I would watch whatever was available from New Japan when I could. just on various like streaming channels, and I'm pretty sure the first matches I ever saw of Tanahashi, where I was even kind of a little bit aware of who he was like the 03 G1, 04. And I'm pretty sure it was years after the fact. And I remember the famous match that I watched was him and Jun Akiyama. I'm pretty sure that's the 03 G1. And he had the rooster haircut. and I was just like, yeah, I don't know who this guy is. Apparently they're pushing him, yada, yada. And it really wasn't till many years later that he became champion. And it's like the way that I would watch Japanese wrestling was like many years after the fact, kind of catching up anything that was available to just stream through back channels. That's usually my way of doing it. I think the big match that really solidified who Tanahashi was to me, the two would probably be like the Muto match at Wrestle Kingdom 3 and the Suwama match in the 08 Champions Carnival. And both of those I didn't see live. I saw them like way after the fact. And that's where I started to get a glimpse of who Tanahashi was. And this was deep in the stretch, like in the points where he's getting booed, you know, and he's kind of almost similar to like how Cena was rejected and they still pushed him at the top anyways. That's kind of what happened with Tanahashi. And the difference is that I found Tanahashi so compelling in these moments where he was able to play against the crowd and play against type and kind of, you know, show his character. And after that, I was aware of who he was. Honestly, the love affair with Tanahashi really didn't start until New Japan was widely accessible and available in the States. Wrestle Kingdom 9, you know, airs. Mm. New Japan World is just getting launched. And then being able to go back and watch his title reigns and watch, you know, the Nakamura feud and watch the Nagata feud and get a greater appreciation for it. But really, I mean, that Wrestle Kingdom 9, you know, pay-per-view that was aired in the States through Global Force, that was, even for people that followed New Japan, it was the turning point where everything just became so much more accessible, you know?
It really feels like such a like nexus point for a lot of people. I know that both Jeremy and yourself and Jeremy, Rich and James have both mentioned Wrestle Kingdom 9. I was a bit later. I kind of started really paying attention with the Omega Okada match from Wrestle Kingdom, which is another one of those sort of nexus points where a lot of people sort of got into things. And, you know, watched the first full show that I watched was 2018. So like earlier in the year of this, when Jericho and Omega had their match, and then Naito and Okada were the other side of the bill on Wrestle Kingdom. That was the first full New Japan show I'd ever watched. You know, there's a number of those sort of jumping on points, but Wrestle Kingdom 9, yeah, it certainly seems to be one of the early ones for, well, as I said, yourself and a lot of people mentioned that. We will hit fast forward on the thing. We could talk a lot about the history of Hiroshi Tanahashi. You've literally done hours and hours of audio. But we're going to fast forward to 2018 because that's when this match that we're going to talk about today took place. It really is like almost a high watermark sort of era for New Japan, a high watermark year. They kicked the year off with a really successful Wrestle Kingdom that I spoke about, you know, featuring that double main event of Omega versus Jericho and then Okada versus Naito. Tanahashi, and of course this match does have two people in it, Kota Ibushi is part of this as well. They were both in prominent singles matches on that Wrestle Kingdom card against Jay White and Cody Rhodes. And there was also a little podcast called Keeping It Strong Style just starting to make waves amongst New Japan fans. What are your memories of 2018, early 2018 New Japan, young boy?
Yeah, so I mean, we launched in late 2017, and at the time there were other, you know, podcasts springing up, and maybe most of them were actually coming after us, but the one that had existed for quite a while that was very well known and well received was the Purocast as part of the Voices of Wrestling. This is a precursor to the Super J Cast with Damon and then his co-host Colin, and they were around for many years, and I wouldn't say they were an inspiration to us doing this, but I was aware of them, and they were the only ones we were aware of. And me and Jeremy were deep into watching New Japan, and we were kind of not heavy on WWE at the time. So I was just like, there's nobody else doing this. Why don't we just do it? And then in short succession, their show actually stopped briefly for about like a, I don't want to know exactly, but I think it was like 2 to 4 months where there was no Purocast, and then Super J Cast eventually launched. So I was like, oh wow, this timing was very fortuitous, because there's kind of this vacuum of nobody else is creating content for this. And then over the years, there've been a plethora of shows that have come and gone. Some have stayed. But yeah, that was a time where 2018, the company was bumping, you know, Jericho would come in, the feud with Omega, the feud with Naito, Kenny's chasing, you know, to go after the title, Okada's legendary reign. There's a lot that's happening in this year. And the two things that are probably very relevant to the match that we're going to talk about today is that in May, Hiroshi Tanahashi, he had finaled in the New Japan Cup against Zach and lost. And then in May, his 11 title defense record was on the verge of being defeated by Kazuchika Okada. So he nominates himself as his challenger to stop the title record from being broken. The same thing Nagata had done to him back in, you know, just before Wrestle Kingdom, I believe it was 5 or 6. And he falls. And when he falls, he like post-match basically says he's going to come back better, stronger than ever, and regain the title. And it's like this moment where nobody believes him. He's said these things in failing moments so many times before, but it's the first time in his career where we're like, he's not better than Okada. He can't beat Okada anymore. And his body is failing. And the fans don't believe him anymore. They don't think that he actually is going to come back and improve. And then on the flip side, you've got Ibushi, who has reunited for the first time in many, many years with Kenny Omega. And for the entirety of their history, it was always Ibushi's number one, Kenny's number two, Kenny's in his shadow, Kenny's chasing him. And then Kenny gets past him, becomes a, you know, the leader of the Bullet Club, wins the G1, finally defeats Okada to win the title. And now it's Ibushi who is in the shadow of Kenny Omega. And not only does he want to surpass him, he wants to challenge him for the title, and they want to headline the Tokyo Dome against one another. And that's kind of the stage that's being set, where Ibushi goes into the B block and Tanahashi goes in the A block, and they both sort of have these individual quests set out before them, you know?
It's funny you mentioned, you're talking about Tanahashi. I remember watching that Dominion, and, you know, he is so far removed from the main event. He's in like this multi-man tag with, he's tagging with Liger and Rey Mysterio, you know, like two legends, but it really is. It's like, he's off in the exhibition division. He's not competing anywhere near the top. He's not going for, you know, the IC title. He's nowhere near the IWGP. He's off in, you know, in this sort of, you know, decent platform, but next to these legends in an exhibition match, essentially. And that's their second biggest show of the year. And Ibushi doesn't even have a match on that card, I don't think. You know, he's cornering Omega. So going into the G1, you know, you're right to say, like, they're very much people that are not appear. They're sort of hiding in plain sight a little bit. Although with Ibushi, you sort of, Tanahashi, you might think he's passed. With Ibushi, you sort of know, like, this is almost him being tested by New Japan a little bit. You know, I get that feeling. You know, he returns in 2017. He's initially a masked wrestler. He's Tiger Mask W. He's then unmasked, and he goes into the G1. He has that exhibition match with Cody at Wrestle Kingdom. He wins, but then he's reunited with Omega, and he really is sort of playing second fiddle in part in that Bullet Club Civil War that he becomes sort of embroiled in. And yeah, going into that G1, it's kind of like them just testing the waters with Ibushi, because he did leave before, you know, testing the waters before they give him that full-on push that, you know, will come eventually if he sticks around. But yeah, as you said, like, talking in the story, you know, his quest is to try and face up against Kenny Omega at Wrestle Kingdom to face for that title that Kenny won.
Yeah, I mean, even the fact that they wound up, that Kenny and Kota Ibushi wound up in the same block and ended up facing one another in the block play in the Nippon Budokan, which is, one of the most legendary arenas, was for many years the home base of All Japan, whereas like Ryogoku was the home base for New Japan. They didn't want to do the match.
Yeah.
And the match is fantastic. It really is. It's one of the best matches. It's one of the best matches in one of the best G1s of all time. 2018's G1 is right up there with 2013, 2014 as being amongst the best ever. And they didn't want to do it. they were really intent on the next match between them either being in the Tokyo Dome or Ryogoku for the title. And they begrudgedly agreed to do the match with the understanding that, all right, but we will get around to the match we want to do. Right. And Ghetto's like, uh-huh. And they're like, right.
Right. Well, they're still playing the long card on that. Let's talk about the G1 Climax 28. You really perfectly set up the stories for both of them going into the G1. I'm just going to reel off some names because when I start reeling through these names, you're just going to feel like at home. You're going to feel comfort. You're going to feel happy in a way that you may not have been when thinking about New Japan for a while. So we've got the A block. You've got Hiroshi Tanahashi in there, of course. He has to go through Kazuchika Okada, Jay White, Minoru Suzuki, Evil, Yoshihashi, Michael Elgin, Togi Makabe, Hangman Page, and Bad Luck Fale. In the B block, of course, you've got Ibushi, as we said. He has to go through Kenny Omega, Zack Sabre Jr., Tetsuya Naito, Tomohiro Ishii, Sanada, Juice Robinson, Hiroki Goto, Toru Yano, and Tama Tonga. Now, I just counted through one thing in this thing. How many people of these had won or will go on to win the IWGP title? Over half is the answer, okay. Which is wild. What a lineup of people to have in a G1.
Yeah, when you asked I was like, it's too early for me to recall. I don't know.
No, I did the sums. It's 11 is the answer.
Wow.
it's a stacked G, absolutely stacked G1. Of course, this is counting people who would go on to win it later on, such as Zack Sabre Jr., Jay White, and Hiroki Goto. Yeah, look, going into this G1, who did you think were the favorites going in, and who did you think would win it? Because I did not think Tanahashi or Ibushi, I can tell you that.
I wish I could tell you. You know, it's funny. I'm a big Stephen King fan, right? And now they've got that show, Welcome to Derry. And I loved the first episode, and it's really starting to fall off for me. But the Muschietti's, the guys who, the brother-sister duo that are doing it, I was listening to this interview where they were talking about how they were dialoguing with Stephen King to understand the like minutia of the lore behind his characters. And they're like, so when you said this and page blah, blah, blah of this many, you know, what did you mean? What does the turtle actually represent? And they're like going through, and Stephen King's like, dude, number one, I don't know. Number two, I wrote that like 40 years ago. He's like, if I did know, which I don't think I did, I don't remember. And that's how I feel right now. Like, there's audio on this. I'm sure I had a favorite at the time, but I do not remember who I thought was going to win the G1 that year. Like, I couldn't even begin to tell you what I was projecting in any way.
Well, you've got to go onto the website, the Wayback Machine, to find it. But there's a column that myself Imp wrote. Cool. And I'm branded as the New Japan noob because at that point I was very new to it. I did actually call Ibushi would come second. I picked that he would beat Omega to go into the final, but I'd been watching a bunch of Showbuckle videos. So I was like, every year I was like, oh, it's going to be Naito's year, right? And, so I thought Naito would beat Ibushi in the final to set that up.
I think just off the top of my head, I can't say what I did think back then. I have no clue. I'm sure it's preserved in audio. And also I feel bad because now that you're bringing up the, the articles you guys used to do. You've always invited me and Jeremy to do those with you guys. And I'm like, I never did get around to doing one of those. But Jeremy's much more.
I think you did a Wrestle Kingdom preview once, and you and Jeremy stomped me and imp into the ground in terms of getting your predictions correct.
I don't think I wrote though. I don't like writing. I can do it, but I hate it. But maybe. With all that being said, though, I would have to assume that there may have been the idea that Okada could have gone back to the Dome and fought for the title again, but he was in the midst of the weird, you know, balloons thing.
The balloon, yep.
So then that probably would have made the favorite, in my mind, either Naito, Jay White, or Kota Ibushi. And the only thing with that is I probably wouldn't have picked Jay White because I'm always very hesitant to ever say that they're going to headline two foreigners in the Tokyo Dome. It's just not their style. They've never done it. Mm. So, I mean, they rarely even do one. So I probably would have been picking, I bet you if I had to guess, I probably, was Naito in the same block as Ibushi?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
Oh, how did I must have, no, I must have, I'll have to go back. I'm going off the top of my head because Naito was in the B block, yeah.
I probably would have predicted, just guessing, something like Okada versus Naito or Okada versus Ibushi to close out the G1. Mm. And I probably was predicting Naito, I would assume. I have no clue, but that's probably what I was doing. Especially since he also was the IC champion, wasn't he? He had just beaten Chris Jericho.
No, he just lost to Chris Jericho.
Did he at Dominion?
Yeah, he lost at Dominion to Chris Jericho.
And does he regain the title from him at Wrestle Kingdom?
Yes. Yep.
Well, that's about it. That's what I can recall. It probably would have been one of those. It would have been one of those two things. I would say Ibushi or Naito probably would have been the favorite in my mind. I probably wasn't counting on Tanahashi. But at the same time, you never know. Rich Latta did do that famous rap. If you guys have never listened to it, I would highly recommend it. It's on YouTube. Just look up Rich Latta, Tanahashi, G1 rap. I'm not sure what the exact title is. But I do think that me and him were having conversations about what if Tanahashi does come back in this G1. And I don't know that I would have like committed to it. But we were talking about it because that's why he created the rap that he does. And and it becomes very prophetic. Or maybe he did it in post. I don't know. But yeah.
Definitely worth. I remember that. I'm trying to remember some of the lines that he did. I won't plagiarize them, and I won't do Rich dirty because I cannot deliver like that man can.
I remember a few of them. He says, Togi Makabe, you are Togi not today.
fantastic.
And he says, he said, you fools, the ace was always going to come back hitting hard.
We're going to have to track it down. We're going to have to put the link. I'm going to find it, and I'm going to put the link in the description. So if you haven't listened to it, the link will be in the description. I'm going to do that. But let's talk about their path through the G1, and then we'll get to the match itself. The thing I remember most about Tanahashi's G1 is that the opening round match against Minoru Suzuki, rips the absolute piss out of Tanahashi's knee, and Tanahashi's journey through the G1 is set. He is hobbled. He is going to be fighting against this knee that Suzuki has just ripped up. And that is his path through the G1. He has to overcome the damage that Minoru Suzuki, you know, a great rival of his, does to him on the very first night of the competition.
Yeah, and if you recall, he had just dropped that title to Suzuki in February at New Beginning, and was stopped by a doctor stoppage due to the damage done to his knee. So this was also kind of playing into that. Plus there was also this is the time where Tanahashi was missing things from time to time and getting, his body was breaking down. He had the torn biceps and his back was bad. His neck was bad. His knees were bad. And, they were really playing that up as part of the story. Like, this guy has mounting, damage done from all the years of him being the top of the company, the ace, working all those hard matches. And Suzuki had already taken advantage of it in February. And it was a game plan that worked then, and he was going to implement it again here.
Indeed. And on Ibushi's side, the thing I remember most about him was just going, he went on an absolute tear through the division. You know, a number of really crazy matches in the way that only Kota Ibushi can, really hard striking. Particularly, there's a match that he has with Tomohiro Ishii in that G1 that was just, I mean, him and Ishii have had a number of very high profile matches, well, very well received matches that have, you know, involved a lot of striking. But this one in particular, they absolutely laid into each other. This was my first G1 that I'd ever watched. And that in particular, that is a match that just stuck out to me as being like, this wrestling is different.
That's the match that is famously so violent that Dave Meltzer wouldn't rate it over a certain limit because it was too dangerous.
Sook. What a sook. Dave Meltzer, what a sook. Of course, they both of these guys end up on the final night with the ability to get into the final. Both of them are against long-term rivals. You've got Tanahashi against Kazuchika Okada, who, you know, as we said earlier in the year, Okada had surpassed Tanahashi's record holding the IWGP strap. It had been a long time since Tanahashi had been able to beat Kazuchika Okada. So, you know, in there with a great rival of his. And then Ibushi against Kenny Omega, you know, he's the fellow golden lover, someone who he has so much long-term history with. And also sort of mixed history as well. You know, we at that point, they were golden lovers, they'd reunited. But before that, there was, you know, there was bad blood from when Omega had joined the Bullet Club. He'd cost Kota Ibushi arguably in a title match against AJ Styles. And, you know, not everything was smooth for the Golden Lovers as they went in. And so you had, you know, setting up in the two block finals to get into the finals, you had both men against great rivals of theirs. Young boy, just highlights from those matches that you can remember.
Yeah, I won't wax too poetically about all of it, but the, I remember at one point people at this around the same time, people were asking me like, what would be a really good match to show somebody what New Japan is all about at that current time, you know? And I've always felt like you don't show somebody the match that you feel like is quote unquote the greatest, but you show them something that encompasses the spirit of the style of the company at that current point in time. And the two that I would always use, I wouldn't do it today, but it would have been Will Ospreay and Ricochet if I wanted to show somebody the top of the junior stuff. Something that is fan-friendly for someone that's not familiar and can really engage them and get them into like, oh, wow, this is really crazy. And the other one was this match between Ibushi and Kenny Omega, because I felt like it really encompassed almost every aspect of what New Japan was like at that time when it comes to the high flying, the hard strikes, you know, the danger of everything, and then the emotion and the drama. So it's a really fantastic match. And the one thing I will say is that as good as the match is, it felt like they were holding back a little bit. As crazy as that sounds, for a match that never would in fact come, and probably at this point never will, just due to the circumstances and the damage that's been done to both those guys' bodies. I don't think they can have the match they ever envisioned. But, you know, Ibushi does get past Kenny Omega to get to the finals. And then on the other end, Tanahashi is able to survive Okada. And he actually is, not only does he survive him, he's in the driver's seat when the match ends. It's not a situation, like in many of their other draws in the G1, it usually comes down to, these guys are equals and neither one can get ahead of the other, or Tanahashi was about to lose and the time limit saved him. But in this one, it was like, if the time kept going, I think Tanahashi might have beaten Okada this time. And that had never really happened in the G1. And this is also the G1 where Tanahashi has the greatest points total that he ever would acquire in his career. He finishes with 15 points. He goes 7-1-1. He only drops one loss in the entire tournament. Everything else is wins and draws.
I will just always remember the ending of that match. I definitely agree with you that Tanahashi was in the driver's seat, and it's like one of those ones where you're like, oh, if he just had a couple more minutes, he'd win. If he just had, even, you know, he's up there to hit the high fly flow, and you're like, oh, if he just hit that high fly flow, he could probably have won and eked it out. And yeah, so and it's a huge thing, right, for Tanahashi, because, you know, for him to be in that position, given that earlier that year he'd been dispensed with by Okada, his legacy as the, you know, the greatest IWGP champion of all time had been sort of overtaken by Okada. So it's a huge thing and a huge statement that Tanahashi is able to get through all that he does and then still is able to take it to Okada in the way that he does and be in the driver's seat when they hit that draw, and it's enough to get him into the final. And then Ibushi, I felt like in that match with Omega, Omega sort of comes out. It's the only time he comes out in like full, what you'd call like cleaner garb for Kenny Omega, you know, like the trench coat, the aviators. And it's like he's trying to make a statement to Ibushi, because of course he lost to Ibushi before and he was sort of the number two in their tag team originally, as you pointed out. It's like he's trying to make a statement in what he's wearing and how he's acting, that he is the top guy. And he like tries to blitzkrieg Ibushi early on and really dominates early on, but Ibushi is able to come back and overcome this, you know, this force of nature that is Kenny Omega, and he goes into the final saying that he is going to now have to beat his wrestling god in Tanahashi, really setting the scene for the match itself.
My mornings are chaos. I need coffee that works as hard as I do. That's why I drink Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's rich, delicious coffee boosted with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Everything I need for focus and balance, ready in 30 seconds. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
And let's move on to that match. It is the final, of course. It's at the Nippon Budokan Hall, which looks amazing. There's 12,000 fans in attendance. This match, as we always do, we'll give it its flowers. It's currently rated 9.73 on Cage Match, the eighth highest match of all time. So a match that is held in genuinely rare air. In terms of the what the critical fans do. Dave Meltzer gave it five and a half stars. But yeah, that Cage Match, the eighth highest match of all time, is pretty special rating to have to be the top 10 matches of all time. You know, say what you want about Cage Match, but there's a lot of people who vote on that thing, and this match is rated very highly. You know, these guys, as they make their entrances, the crowd is, you know, it's behind both of them, but you can really feel the energy in the room for Tanahashi. And of course, if there was any doubt as to who the emotional weight was behind, it is completely put behind Tanahashi when Shibata is revealed to be in his corner. Now, if you've been listening to Josh to the Young Boys Ace of the Universe series, you'll know how important Shibata is to the Tanahashi story. And of course, this is where, after Shibata had suffered what most people thought would be it was a life-threatening head injury, and most people thought career-ending head injury as well. This was one of the first times that he had appeared since that injury happened, and he shows up in Tanahashi's corner to help the ace win. Josh, how did you feel when you saw Shibata show up at this moment?
Yeah, he had only really made a couple appearances publicly in a wrestling capacity up to that point. And the year earlier at the G1 Climax, after his, you know, unfortunate head injury in that famous match with Okada, he came out and basically just said, "I'm alive. That's it. That's enough." And he did a bump and just sat in the ring, and everyone like cried. And it was like super emotional. And then a year later, he comes out with Tanahashi to support him. And there's so much layered history, both positive and negative, between Tanahashi and Shibata. And we won't dig into all of that. If you, you know, if you want to listen to my series, The Ace of the Universe, you'll hear more about what took place over the between those two guys over the subsequent years, or the previous years. But the idea that he would come out and support Tanahashi, a guy that he came up in the dojo with, who was one of his biggest rivals, and give him the support to continue on and go for this one last run to chase the title. And it kind of juxtaposed against the fact that Kenny, as the champion, is taking a backseat to Kota Ibushi and supporting him, similar to the way that Kota had done for him at Dominion, where he won the title. And all of these guys have varying degrees of history with one another. So it all just kind of, like, you know, matches up and creates this very elaborate stage for these two guys to compete on, with, you know, all these different conflicting emotions and feelings from the crowd, because the crowd has connections to all four of these guys.
Yeah, with Shibata, I got the impression, and this is completely unspoken, but it's like, now you're winning. You're in this for both of us now. I can't win this anymore. I'm here to support you because you're doing it for both of us. You're the guy that, you know, we shared a room together when we were young lions, you know, and there's water under the bridge, but, you know, we're here now together and you're doing it for both of us. And, you know, Chris Charlton sums it up. He just goes, could this get any more emotional?
Yeah.
When Shibata shows up, it's a great line. And then, you know, when the bell rings, there's a huge bell pop. And I'm just sitting there, you know, the crowd is clapping, Tanahashi, Tanahashi. And then you can hear some people being a boo, Ibushi, Ibushi. But the crowd, you can feel, you know, like the air is thick with emotion and energy from that crowd. It's a really slow feeling out process early on. They're almost sort of playing around wrestling. Like it's really light touch early on. I'd forgotten how slow this match was at first. And I don't mean that as an insult either, by the way. We'll talk about pacing later. But, you know, Tanahashi's got a slight wrestling advantage, and then Ibushi has an upper hand when it comes to striking. The first 5 minutes go by. They do the 5 minute call and barely anything has happened. But it's completely riveting, and the crowd is so into every single little thing that these two do, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, they had had, up to this point, already three other matches, and two of them were in the G1, and Tanahashi had won their first match in 2015, but 2017, Ibushi had already beaten him in the G1, and that entitled him to an IC title match against Tanahashi at Power Struggle the prior year in 2017. And up to this point, that was considered the best match these two had ever had. And Tanahashi defeated Ibushi in what was, by all accounts, a really incredible match. And in all three of those instances, there was this palpable feeling that if either of these guys gets their signature stuff in, they can turn the tide very quickly and win. And I think that that's like basically lending itself to the story here in the early goings, why it's so slow, because both guys know how dangerous the other one are. They're trying to find the opening to work their style of match and take over the pace, but also avoid creating the opening that will enable the other guy to do the same thing, you know?
Mm. Absolutely. And one thing I wanted to bring up while we're talking about just the early goings on of this match is, can we talk about how New Japan, you know, light and film their matches? Mm. I just think it's easily, by such a long stretch, the best cinematography in wrestling. You know, people talk about how, like, AEW, you know, stole wrestlers from New Japan or stole a style from New Japan, whatever. I wish they had stolen the way that New Japan filmed their matches. You know, like the steady low angles, they're always looking up at the wrestlers, which makes them look like I think I call it makes them look like gods. And the lighting, the navy blue that they sort of bathe the crowd in. It's such a perfect balance between having the ring spotlighted and the crowd visible. And it feels, because the ring is spotlighted and because of the low angles that they use, they can be tighter than they are on the hard cram, so it feels more intimate. So you get like more of the emotion from the wrestlers as well. I just love the New Japan production. Every time I go back to it, the first thing I think of is just this is the best production in wrestling.
Yeah, my wife, before we got, you know, together. Not long after this, honestly, we started dating in 2019, right? So just a year later. And she grew up as a wrestling fan. She was a wrestler. She is, to some extent. I think being with me has kind of maybe squelched some of that passion. But
I don't want to watch Kobashi Misawa again, Josh.
But well, you know, we enjoy wrestling for very different reasons. Like the stuff that I like, she's like, you don't get it. It's not about that. It's about this skit with, you know, with whatever. But she's like her favorite, the height of her favorite stuff in wrestling would be like Gold Dust and like Booker T, you know. But anyways, when we got together, she started watching New Japan, and me and her are both very, very huge cinephiles, like almost to an annoying degree. And she was like, wow, I've never seen anyone shoot wrestling in this way. You know, even to this day, like that's something that really sticks out to her, is like the way that it's shot. Mm. It's so
cinematic is the right word. Cinematic is the cinematic. Right word, I reckon.
I'm too yep. tired to remember all my words, but yeah, it's so cinematic in the way that it's presented. It's not even, you know, there are some sports elements, but it's not, it's just a shock to see that when you're used to, you know, mid 2000s, 40 cuts WWE, you know, with Kevin Dunn at the helm.
It's miles better than even the good version of that, which WWE and AEW have now, where it's not the 40 cuts, but you know, you're relying on that hard cam. And I think that the way New Japan shoots its wrestlers makes them look bigger. Mm-hmm. Like they look bigger, they look stronger, they look, as I said, like gods. And you know, while we're talking about production, how good were Kevin Kelly, Chris Charlton, and Rocky? Like their combination of move calling, nerdiness, attention to detail, but then also like raw emotion. It was just, they managed to strike such a good balance.
Yeah, I think pound for pound, they're just simply one of the greatest. One of the greatest desks that has ever existed for calling pro wrestling. And this might be one of their, you know, if you look at their resume, this has got to be like in the top two or three calls of their entire career, honestly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. After 5 minutes or so, you know, the pace does start to pick up a bit. You get the first major knockdown, Ibushi, with like some really crisp strikes. And there's just like this great flow to everything, this great chemistry. Tanahashi gets some offense in. He's going after Kota Ibushi's knee. Of course, Ibushi's main finisher, the Kamigoye, is a knee strike. So Tanahashi's trying to neutralize that. And we get our first really dominant flurry of offense as well. When Ibushi knocks Tanahashi to the outside, Ibushi sort of runs to go for his triangle moonsault. But then adjusts mid-jump as he sees Tanahashi coming in and gets a double stomp on the apron. Beautiful sequencing, like these two are familiar with each other. They're countering, there's counters to the counters. I love that element of wrestling when they, you know, where they're playing off their knowledge of each other as athletes and as wrestlers.
You know, the thing, something that I've learned about Tanahashi doing the series that I'm doing is that when he was young, he was basically given this moniker, the genius of the sun, you know, and he never liked being saddled with that nickname because it basically created this expectation. Like, it's not a perfect translation, but I've watched and read a lot of like anime and manga. And when guys are quote unquote geniuses and they're young, what they're really referring to is like a prodigy, someone who is so supernaturally or naturally gifted in a way that it belies their actual experience, you know? Tanahashi never was that prodigy. This was a guy who did struggle in many areas of pro wrestling, and it was only through hard work and dedication that he was able to circumvent those limitations that he had as a performer and as an athlete. Whereas in his estimation, guys that he has listed, like, I think these are true prodigies, guys that were like actual geniuses in the West, he thinks that Bryan Danielson and AJ Styles fit that mold. And then in Japan, the guys that he's wrestled that he was like, they're absolutely geniuses would be like Marufuji, Okada, and Ibushi. And I think of all of them, he puts Ibushi at the very top of the heap just in terms of how good he was physically as an athlete from day one and what he could physically do with like no actual, you know, I mean, this was a guy who started as a backyarder, self-trained. And the reason I mention all that is this. Ibushi, where he is different from Okada, if you watch the early Okada Tanahashi series, Okada was always someone susceptible to the legwork of Tanahashi, and that became a big central story point of their matches, which is makes sense because that's Tanahashi's calling card. Ever since he came into his prime, he's always worked the legs of his opponents. That's kind of his thing, kind of like Ric Flair. But with Ibushi, it never worked. And on the one hand, you could probably point to the fact that as good as Ibushi is, his psychology probably wasn't always perfect, and he's a guy that I'm going to get my flips in no matter what. Maybe I'm not going to care so much about this selling, which might be a shortcoming of his. But there's also a kayfabe explanation where it's like, you can go after my leg, but I'm kind of a monster, and it doesn't matter how hard you try and slow me down, it's not going to actually work. And that was kind of the big difference between him and Okada. Like, Tanahashi has this game plan. It always worked with everybody else. But when he tries it with Ibushi, it has some effect. Ibushi's going to, you know, he's going to sell the leg submissions, and he might shake the leg out a little bit. But when it comes time to start hitting the moonsaults and throwing the kicks and coming off the top rope and off the apron, he's still going to land all, he's going to get all his shit in, and it's not going to change any bit at all. And from a character standpoint, it's like Tanahashi's faced with this guy that is younger than him, more durable than him, hits harder, he's faster, he's stronger. How the fuck is he going to beat this monster? Especially with a game plan that always works on Okada, the other genius that he has had to try and overcome. It doesn't work with Ibushi. What do you do now?
And Ibushi is just such a physical freak that he can pull that off. Like, he can pull off being just this physical freak who is able to shrug off these attacks on his legs and is able to just pump himself up with adrenaline. He looks, you look at him, you can see every single inch of his muscles because he's so bloody lean. And he looks like the kind of guy that could do that, that could just shrug it off, pump himself up with adrenaline and go for those things, even when his leg has been attacked by someone like Tanahashi. And you're right that, like, Tanahashi's game sort of changes a little bit because after that sequence that I just spoke about, you get more of Tanahashi getting frustrated, getting into striking games. And one of the things I wanted to point out when Tanahashi, we're going to talk about his body language and things throughout this match, but there's this one moment when they're throwing strikes at each other and you can see him, like, the way he's putting effort into it and the way he's pumping himself up by, like, grasping his fists together and shrugging his shoulders. You know, it's such a perfect example of how he is able to play to the cameras, you know, getting the grasping the fists and stuff. You wouldn't really see that. But then the, you know, shrugging his shoulders, playing to the cheap seats in the arena as well, when he's doing this striking exchange. And you can see, you know, the way he's drawing us in with his emotion, watching on TV, but also the people in the arena showing how he's feeling in that moment, showing his frustration, showing how he's trying to pump himself up. You know, he's like wrinkling his lip as he's going through these strikes with Ibushi, and Ibushi's laying into him and he's trying to lay in back as well.
Yeah, he's never been a great striker. Some people might not agree with that, but in the history of, like, pro wrestling, you look at top guys that can throw great strikes. Tanahashi's not one of them. He's fine. The thing he's most famously known for is having a very powerful, you know, slap, and that's on display in this match. But, you know, he could throw an elbow here and there, but he's not a great striker. And obviously, Ibushi was a K2 level striker in the shoot world, and he translated that into his wrestling, and he's got the edge in every aspect when it comes to striking with Tanahashi. But like you mentioned earlier, there's this aspect to the story where it's like Tanahashi's facing Father Time, but Ibushi is facing what he considers to be the god of pro wrestling, you know? So it's like he idolizes Tanahashi to this certain extent, and when he tries to beat him at wrestling and he can't, he starts to go into that deeper, darker place. And when they're on the apron and he, you know, attacks him with the knees and the stomps and all that, it's, you can see that Ibushi is starting to move away from pure wrestling and move into like the darker phase of who he is and what he's capable of. And that really starts to come out during these strike exchanges. And he's willing to move away from pure wrestling and the innate goodness of what makes Kota Ibushi Kota Ibushi as a star. And there's almost this like mirror aspect. Like Tanahashi rarely in his career has ever had to move away from his ethos to overcome. You know, he always has a game plan. He's always able to be, for lack of a better word, like a Super Cena, like a Sting, like a Hogan, a guy that can dig down deep, stay true to who he is, and win. But for Ibushi, he usually has to actually deviate from that and go into the quote-unquote murder Ibu. He has to go into a dark place to overcome the top guys, and he starts to do that against the God of Pro Wrestling. He almost is like abandoning the mirror aspect of this guy that he idolizes. And when Tanahashi fires back with an even deeper resolve to be like, no, fuck that. Like, I'm the ace. And when like you watched Ibushi in these matches and he goes to that dark place. Yeah. Some guys have survived it and beaten him like Nakamura. But for the most part, when it's coming to those stanzas, nobody is able to actually take what he throws at them. They have to basically evade or defend or avoid. But Tanahashi goes through the fire and is able to accept it and survive through it and then thrive because he has this deeper resolve, that this commitment to what he is after. And it takes Ibushi completely off guard. Like, he wasn't expecting the quote-unquote fighting spirit, the Tanahashi, from this aged veteran to be able to overcome what he's throwing at him. And it's shocking, not just for him, but for everybody. It's pretty much one of the most famous moments of the match. Anytime me and Jeremy bring up this match, we're always like, yeah, Tanahashi walking through those slaps and then throwing them back is like, that's the moment where you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, look, to set it up, you know, there's build up to that where they do start, as you say, like things really start to escalate. You get, you know, Tanahashi makes a mistake, gets caught on the ropes, and Ibushi then drops him on his neck in it like a really gross looking bastard driver. And then Tanahashi sort of turns things back on Ibushi and like these very intense dragon screws and gets a clover leaf on. He's like twisting Ibushi's body in like really, you know, unnatural ways. You know, they're really putting a lot of physicality into this match. There's a lot of close calls and Ibushi does start to get the upper hand, or it seems like he does. He hits Tanahashi, or he hits a poison rana off the top rope onto Tanahashi's neck, and then another bridging suplex and a bomb AA as the pace gets up. And yeah, then it's sort of, you see that switch flick in Ibushi after Tanahashi starts sort of just desperately swinging for the fences. Ibushi's switch flicks. He lays out these insane palm strikes. You know, you get an incredible reaction from the desk when he hits the first one, and the crowd as well. That everyone just recoils in horror as Ibushi hits this ridiculous palm strike on Tanahashi and pushes him down into the corner. He's kicking Tanahashi as he's down on the ground. The ace is down. He's beaten down. Ibushi is just being brutal on him. But as you said, like, this is the ace. This is Tanahashi. This is the man that, you know, will not let time beat him. You know, He looks into things and he says, no, age is not going to weary me. And he rages and rages against the dying light of time. He comes out of that corner and Ibushi lands an absolutely huge slap on Ibushi. And then Ibushi starts unloading him on him. But Tanahashi is not fazed. He advances on Ibushi, and as Ibushi hits him harder and harder, it only pumps Tanahashi up more and more. The facial expressions, the emotion, the crowd is roaring for the ace at this moment. And Chris Charlton is going off his head, screaming for Tanahashi as well. I don't think there's much better emotional moments in wrestling than that exchange. You know, you can see, we said cinematic before, and you can almost see, like, you know, if this was a movie, when Tanahashi's down in that corner, you can see, like, him having the flashback of, you know, like, his time in the dojo, his time as a champion, Okada beating him, people surpassing him. And he's like, no, I can't let this go. I've promised that I've promised the crowd, I've made an oath to these people that love me and support me, that I'm going to come back for one more reign. I can't let things end this way. I can't let myself be surpassed. And he rages out of the corner. Like, you can almost see him, you know, like picking up the dust off the ground and letting it slip through his hands as he, like, contemplates all these things that he's done in his life, and then raising up and just raging back across the ring at Kota Ibushi. It's like, truly, this is like one of my favorite moments in wrestling that's happened.
Yeah, it's my favorite. It's my favorite moment of Tanahashi's entire career is that moment and him going through those strikes and then powering up. And I know it's, if you think about it in a certain sense, it is kind of just like a Hulk Hogan Hulk up, but it's done in such a realistic and emotional way that and it's not something that was done prior to this match, maybe ever in his career, and maybe he never does it again. So, you know, that's the thing. What makes it exceptional is the fact that it is an exception, and him doing that and the right stage, the right crowd, the right opponent, the right moment, it is just magic. And it's like, oh my God, like I can buy into this 100%. And I want nothing more than, as much as I love Ibushi, I want nothing more than the ace to fucking do it one last time, you know?
Yep. Yeah. And you know, you do see wrestlers try and do this, like, and great wrestlers try and do this. Like, I've seen Eddie Kingston do this a number of times to varying degrees of success, but I've never seen it done like this with the emotion. And you know, that all goes to the history that Tanahashi has with the crowd, but also just the way that Tanahashi wrestles, the way that we talked about how he projects himself. It's a spine tingling moment. And you know, like, from that moment, he's desperate. Ibushi gets desperate. He lays out this clothesline where Chris Charlton yells, Ibushi's arm was just long enough to punch God, which is just like, what a line, incredible line. You know, it's hyperbole, but it's just such a heightened moment that these kind of lines just make sense. And, you know, Ibushi's just like so desperate to land a killing blow at that point. But he never gets to. You know, when Tanahashi goes for that high fly, he goes for his first high fly flow, he does have the knees up, but he isn't able to actually land that killing blow that he knows he needs to, and he's so desperate to do it, but he can't. And as the match enters its final stanza, you know, as I said, like, it's desperation time for Ibushi. He does a moonsault into a double knee, and then he lawn darts Tanahashi into the corner, and, you know, then another, just like this brutal second rope German and last ride. He's trying to put Tanahashi out, but Tanahashi is just so overcome with this emotion. He's so full of that spirit, and the crowd is so far behind him that, you know, he can't, no matter what he does, he cannot get the killing blow. Tanahashi counters a Kamigoye twice. He then hits back-to-back twist and shout neck breakers, a dragon suplex of himself, leaves Ibushi on his back, where, you know, Ibushi can't get the knees up for the high fly flow. So it's kind of like, you know, even amongst all this emotion, he's learning. He's now got Ibushi with his back up rather than in his stomach up. So Ibushi can't get the knees up. Hits the first high fly flow. The second one, I love this shot, Josh. Mm-hmm. Ibushi rises as the ace rises on the second rope. And it's where we're talking about Ibushi having Tanahashi as his god. He's like, he can't get his hands up even. He can't do anything to defend himself. He's just looking as his god descends down on him. And the shot is from behind. from behind Ibushi. So Ibushi's got his back. You see Tanahashi come down and then hit a, go up again to hit the final third high fly flow and get the ending, get the pin. Incredible ending sequence, isn't it?
Yeah, one thing we didn't touch on, you did a fantastic job kind of recapping, you know, the ins and outs there, but there was one point where, Ibushi used the Bombaye as an allusion to, you know, the history of Tanahashi and Nakamura, and then obviously Ibushi's history with Nakamura as well. And he tries that at first and he lands it and it's effective, but he's not able to put away Tanahashi with that. And then, like you mentioned, he goes a couple times for the Kamigoye. And this was specifically a finish that was designed to defeat Tanahashi. You know, he had debuted it the prior year in the G1. And, you know, the translation of the Kamigoye is something along the lines of like the God Killer knee, because it was intended. It's the evolution of what the Bombaye is, and they sound similar. And it's the idea that, like, all right, Nakamura had his version, I'm going to develop my own so that I can beat Tanahashi. And he does beat him in the G1 with it. But since then, Tanahashi was, you know, he's not going to be caught off guard with that move again. He knows how dangerous it is. And he has the ring wherewithal to the first time dodge it, you know, basically feigning exhaustion, but he dodges it. And then the second one, he blocks it. And he knows what, even in moments where he's on the underside of the match and he's underneath, he knows, he has enough awareness to be like, I'm not going to get fucking hit with this thing. But at the end, when he, like you mentioned, Ibushi gets erratic. He gets desperate. He starts throwing everything at him. I do think the last ride that he hits Tanahashi with during this final stanza is a moment that people really bite on for one of the greatest near falls in the match, because he hits it perfectly. Mm. And
and it's after so many like brutal moves as well.
And Tanahashi had been beaten with that move in the 08 Champions Carnival by Suwama. So it was something he was susceptible to. That was Ibushi's finisher before the Kamigoye. So it was believable he could have beaten him with that. And, you know, Tanahashi kicks out. But when he hits this stanza of high fly flows, like you had talked about, there's almost like a thematic thing going on. Like the first one, he hits him from the back and it's almost like, all right, this one breaks the spirit of Ibushi. And Ibushi is still defiant. He stands up, but he's like basically done. And when Tanahashi hits him with that one, it's like, all right, you're going to stand. Nope. I'm going to humble you. And then the last one is just acceptance. Like there's nothing left to give. Mm. There's nothing left to do. The defeat is coming and he beats him. And when the match is over, yeah, there's elation for Tanahashi. But when you look at the face of Ibushi, he's heartbroken because he really had this goal of facing, you know, Kenny Omega, you know, the other half of the Golden Lovers, and beating, like in his mind, in a perfect world, he beats his idol and then he goes on to face, you know, Kenny Omega, his partner, in the biggest stage possible. And that is taken away from him by this aged legend. And then when you look at Tanahashi, it's not elation, or it's not like, hey, good try, kid, see you later. He has compassion and he's like, he is almost heartbroken for what he had to do to Ibushi, because they're both hontai. You know, he still can relate to what is happening there, and it's almost like he's conflicted about the whole thing.
The crowd, one part, I agree with you completely there, but one part of the things who is not conflicted is the crowd. Mm. The crowd is exploding for Tanahashi, especially when Shibata carries him around on his shoulders. And the commentators are riding that emotion as well. Like Charlton says, the ace has come back. Kevin Kelly says the G in G1 stands for God. It's like all-time high vibes. But you're right. There's like an interesting moment there where, you know, you've got Omega in the ring as well, who is the person that Tanahashi is now going to go and face. And Omega is concerned for Ibushi, but you can see he's not happy looking up at Tanahashi as well, as Tanahashi stands over them. It's an interesting moment there, you know, while the crowd, while there's so much jubilation and emotion in the crowd, mm-hmm. it's an interesting moment there between the wrestlers themselves as they're, you know, there for each other, kind of.
Yeah. And, you know, you almost get the feeling like, okay, Tanahashi, he's defeated Ibushi. This clearly feels like, for instance, in the match with Okada, that match truly felt like not necessarily a definitive next chapter of their story. It's a lot of it is we're going to play the hits, and then the close is going to be like the most significant aspect of it, but it's kind of retreading old territory. This match in the finals feels like, okay, this is a true definitive chapter of this ongoing story between Tanahashi and Ibushi. And you would almost feel like, all right, we're going to get more down the road. There's more coming, especially considering the fact that, like, you know, Tanahashi, he goes on and he does defeat Kenny Omega in the Tokyo Dome. He unseats him for the title and sends Kenny packing from the company. There's so much to build on there, like this rich narrative. But these guys really only face each other two more times in their entire careers. The next one is in the G1. It's just a block match. And then in 20, and that's the next year. And then in 2021, they do, during the peak of, you know, COVID, they wrestle for the US title and Tanahashi beats him. Tanahashi beats him in both their last two matches. Really, like, Ibushi's only beaten him once. And now he's retiring, and they never really... No, I'm sorry. Ibushi beat him in 2019. I apologize. So he beat him twice. But they never really had this next definitive follow-up to this. And you would think that there would have been some other definitive big match between them where Ibushi finally surpasses him or, you know, seeks vengeance, but it just never comes.
Especially after, you know, they then go on to tag together in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think after that there would be some sort of, there would have probably been something more planned. Of course, Ibushi had, you know, a horror run with injuries, fell out with the company, and, you know, now is injured again, unfortunately. So, and Tanahashi is going to retire. So, yeah, I agree. They didn't really ever, they came back to this, but not on the stage that this match had. And not with the emotional stakes or you know, kayfabe stakes that this match had either, in terms of, you know, like it was never, as you said, like the most prestigious was that it was for the US title, which is, you know, as good as the US title is and as important as it had been at different points, it's not a G1 final. So it's not on the same level as this, I don't think. Yeah, if we can move along, is there anything more you'd just like to say about the match itself, the ending, the final part before we move on to looking at the legacy, Josh?
No, we can move on.
Yep. So I just had a couple of questions left to talk about this match. As I said, look, this is my favorite match of all time, cards on the table. I've gone back to this match a number of times, and I love it every time I've come back to it. You have watched a lot more Puro Rezzo than me, though. You've watched a lot more Tanahashi than me as well. In your mind, is this Tanahashi's greatest match? You know, according to Cage Match and me, it is. But what would you say? You know, there's the Okada's matches. There's the Suzuki matches at Wrestle Kingdom, Nakamura in the G1 final. Some really love the Omega match at Wrestle Kingdom. When you're talking greatest Tanahashi match, where does this match fall for you?
I mean, it's easily in that conversation, and it's on the very short list. You know, I would easily say it's a top five match of Tanahashi's career. If someone were to say it is the best match of his career, I wouldn't really begrudge them or fight them on it. I think that probably the Wrestle Kingdom 10 match would be the other one that you'd want to consider as being like, all right, we could, you know, talk about that one as also being the other, you know, the other one, or maybe even Wrestle Kingdom 9's main event. Those are, you know, easily up there. And like you said, some people might say the Nakamura G1 final from 2015. Some people might say the Suzuki King of Pro Wrestling match, the Kenny match from Wrestle Kingdom's up there. So, I mean, it's easily on that very, very, very short list of top matches. But, yeah, it probably is depending on your taste, it probably is the best match of Tanahashi's career.
It's funny you mentioned that Omega match. I mentioned it as well. It's like, it's a weird match where I've just never connected with it for some reason. I love both the guys in it, but I've watched it maybe twice, maybe three times. And each time I've been like, this is good, but I don't know. It's just not connecting with me in the way that Omega or Tanahashi normally connect. It's a weird one for me. But yeah, look, as I said, like, this is the emotion of this match, that moment with the ending, you know, from the where they're trading those strikes to the ending sequence where there's just that desperation. This is as good as it gets for me when it comes to wrestling. And of course, the reason that we did want to talk about this was because it's Tanahashi's retirement coming up in a few weeks' time. It's, you know, a time to honor and think about the legacy of this great wrestler, this great man who has, you know, given so much to wrestling. You just need to look at the way that this bloke walks. Like, I feel I'm, you know, just in admiration and have just so much respect and thankfulness that I got to see. And, you know, I'm not even the biggest New Japan watcher out there, but, you know, you only need to sort of see what this man has done for wrestling to be thankful. And I'm curious, Josh, you know, all of that said, where for you he ranks in terms of the, like, the greatest New Japan and Japanese wrestlers of all time. Obviously it's, you know, amongst the absolute heavyweights. But, you know, where would you put him in that conversation?
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to heavyweights in New Japan, and, you know, not just talking about ability, but cultural relevance, you know, business, drawing ability, importance in the kayfabe, all of that, like, he's probably number two, you know, maybe number one, depending. The short list is him, Inoki, Hashimoto, Okada, basically. I put all of them above, you know, the other names that you would think of, like the Chonos and the Mutos and the Naitos and Omega and, you know, whoever else you might list. But Tanahashi is the most important figure in the company's history outside of the founder, Antonio Inoki, you know, in terms of, like, you know, all time Japanese talent, I think that he is firmly on the short list of, you know, if you were to give me a top 10 Japanese heavyweights, including the best from, you know, All Japan and New Japan and any of the other big companies, you can't have that list without Tanahashi on it. And in terms of, like, in ring work and ability, he's easily been one of the greatest in-ring workers of all time. Let me put it this way. I know that, like, awards don't define everything, but he's one of the few guys, along with, like, Okada and Misawa, to win the Tokyo Sports MVP, you know, three times. He's one of the few guys that has won the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Award as many times as he did. I think he won it 3 years back to back, and he was named the 2010 Wrestler of the Decade by that same publication. And that was just based on his perception as being the top guy in wrestling over those, you know, over that decade. And many people consider the 2010s as being, like, the peak era of the best of pro wrestling. Even as good as wrestling is now, a lot of people still point back, oh, the 2010s, that was, like, even better than what it is right now. And it's hard to argue against a guy that is perceived by so many people as being one of, if not the best in his era.
And in many ways, like, the guy who sort of launched that era in how he bought New Japan, you know, he's sort of the guy that's given credit for bringing New Japan out of the dark ages and being such an important, the most important part of creating the environment that caused the 2010s to happen the way that it did and unfold the way that it did.
Yeah. It's also really amazing that the 2010s are such peak years for him, when for the vast majority of that decade, he wasn't even really truly the top guy of the company that he was in. He was just the best wrestler.
Josh, I feel like I could talk to you about Hiroshi Tanahashi for hours and hours more. I'd love to go into more matches and everything, but this is a podcast where we talk about the one match and we get in and get out. I really appreciate you coming on today. Is there anything further you'd like to say about Tanahashi or Ibushi? We shouldn't forget Ibushi as well. before we get out of here today.
Yeah. I haven't seen the injury that Ibushi, I haven't been really watching a lot of AEW, so I haven't seen the injury with his what's the big bone in your thigh?
His femur.
Yeah, he broke his femur.
Yeah.
Hope he gets better. You know, hope he lives a long, healthy life. I'm going to be in Tokyo to see Tanahashi's final match. Very excited for that. I don't have much more to say. I appreciate you bringing me on the show. I know that, you know, you are a big New Japan fan, but your show is mostly centered on AEW, so I wasn't expecting to do something like this. So I think it's a cool opportunity. And I will be reviewing this match probably in a lot less in-depth fashion when I do the 2018 version of Ace, you know, Tanahashi Ace of the Universe. And this probably helps me out a little bit in having to go as in-depth because it's going to be fresh in my memory here. But I am looking forward to that. And I think that anyone who is listening that found enjoyment out of this, I really think you would really enjoy what the work that I'm putting forth with the Tanahashi Ace of the Universe series. It's available on our Patreon, Keeping It Strong Styles Patreon, for just $5. And it's well worth your time. We started in 1999. I'm getting ready to record 2013. And I am committed to have every year of his career up to 2025 done before January 4th, which is, you know, we're talking about like 8 weeks from now, basically. So I got to get cracking on that, but I'm pumping them out. And I appreciate you guys having me on the show here, Sam. And, you know, hopefully we can do some more audio here in the future. And, I don't have much more to say.
Absolutely. Look, as I said at the start, I really appreciate you coming on, Josh. I've, you know, long been a fan of your work, been on Keeping It Strong Style once myself back in the pandemic days, and, you know, love chatting back and forth with you in the Discord, on the, you know, the various group chats and everything. I'm a big fan of what you do. So yeah, thank you for jumping on and talking about a match that is near and dear to my heart. I don't know what I'm going to be doing with the match guide for people who are listening out there. I don't know what I'm going to be doing with the match guide in the near future. This was sort of a once-off special episode, but it has given me a bit of a taste of maybe, I was thinking, you know, thinking of maybe doing like origin stories for AEW wrestlers or something, and looking at, you know, matches that they've had deep in their past that weren't necessarily in AEW, just as a way to keep things fresh and do something different. So let me know, jump on the Social Suplex Discord. I could talk all day about this match in particular, but let me know, if you'd like to hear that. Maybe I could go back and talk about some more New Japan. There's plenty of people in AEW who came out of New Japan. I could talk about some more New Japan stuff, talk about, you know, some old stuff that some of these guys have done who've gone on to other things. So jump into the Discord, let me know.
Well, one thing here, Sam, and this is, you mentioned earlier that I'm part of the Four Pillars.
The Four Musketeers, mate. I said Four Musketeers. This is a New Japan podcast, mate. We're not talking all Japan here.
Well, what's funny is at one point we had in our we have a group chat in a Facebook Messenger, and at one point it was titled the Executive VPs of Social Suplex, and then I think right now it says it's the Four Pillars. So
I think I called you guys that at one point as well. I think I've called Jeremy and James that at one point or another.
I might change it to the Four Musketeers. That's funny. I can speak. I don't usually speak with authority on this show or on the network, because I'm just the guy, the talent. I just show up and talk. I don't really run shit. But the only thing we really care about, we don't really care about what people want to listen to. We don't care about attracting an audience. It's cool if we do. We just care about passion. Whatever you would like to do, Sam, that's what we care about. It's not about duty. It's not about obligation. It's not about, like, you know, anything like that. If you want to do these side projects at whatever leisurely time you want, however you want to do it, that's all we care about. We just want people who are involved in this to care about what they're doing. and be passionate about it. And if people listen, if they dig it, great. If not, fuck them, because you know, we know our shit's hot, and that's about it, really.
Oh, mate, I love that. I love being part of Social Suplex. It's great. It's a great place to be. And we got the best podcast as well. Like, check out our other podcasts if you've listened to this and enjoyed it. Plenty of other podcasts on the network if you haven't listened to them before. Of course, Josh is on Keeping It Strong Style. There will be only be ratcheting things up as we get closer to Wrestle Kingdom. They're always popular shows. They're previews and reviews of Wrestle Kingdom and the matches coming up in previewing it. And then, of course, One Nation Radio, Tunnel Talk, the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast, Imps AEW Adventures, and Wrestle Art with Chris Things. Check us all out. It's great shows. As you said, Josh, a lot of passion. And that's what we're about here. We're fans, we're creators, and we talk about what gets our juices flowing. And this is a match that gets my juices flowing. And even, you know, 11:45 at night, and for you, you know, 6:00 in the morning. So yeah, it's been a pleasure having you on. And just a thank you to everyone who's also joined us today and listen through. Jump on the Discord, jump on the Social Suplex Discord. Let me know what you thought of this match. Hit up Josh as well. Let him know what you thought. And yeah, check out Josh's Ace of the Universe series as well. Fantastic, a fantastic series that's well worth checking out. But until I see you again, I thank you very much, Josh, for jumping on. And I thank everyone for listening. And I will catch you again later.
Go Ace.
Thanks for listening to the AEW Match Guide podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then you can subscribe on the podcast app of your choice so you never miss an episode. Also, feel free to let me know on Twitter at Sir_Samuel. I'd love to hear from you. The AEW Match Guide podcast is brought to you by the Social Suplex Podcast Network, where you can find many other fantastic podcasts discussing not just AEW, but all parts of the world of professional wrestling. Looking forward to seeing you again next week. I'm Sam Brown.